Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
When no Americans answered Chris Saborin's advertisement seeking a dance teacher for her Connecticut-based studio, she looked outside the United States. But Saborin faced difficulty there as well. Limitations on U.S. visa requests restricted her search. She and others argue the new rules are harming the ballroom dance industry. Saborin spent a year and thousands of dollars trying to employ a top ballroom dancer from Greece. But when she arrived, American officials detained the Greek woman at New York's Kennedy Airport. Then they sent her back home. It would just be nice to know why we're having such a hard time, Saborin told the Associated Press, or AP, news agency. It's affecting our business, definitely. She says the popular television program Dancing with the Stars has fueled interest among Americans in learning dances like the foxtrot and tango. But dance studio owners say efforts to employ professional teachers are limited without international help. Owners and legal experts say many requests for visas are going unanswered. They say evidence requests from officials are increasing and that sometimes what is asked for has already been provided or is not necessary. Immigration law experts say President Donald Trump's administration has created barriers that have made hiring more difficult for all kinds of U.S. industries. This includes ballroom dance, as well as science and technology. In January, the American Immigration Lawyers Association released a report on data from the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. The organization found that average case processing time increased 46% from 2016 to 2018. In late May, the Government Accountability Office told lawmakers that it plans to investigate the report's findings. The AP took a look at federal records and found a small increase in first rejections of O-1 visa requests, the usual kind sought by foreign dancers. The AP also found a decrease in the number of times individuals were given a second chance to meet the requirements for the visa. Jose Zuquilanda had visited the U.S. many times on tourist visas. He had hoped to compete, train, teach, dance, and learn how to run a business through employment at an American studio in Connecticut. He went far through the O-1 visa process before a final denial at an American diplomatic office in his home country of Ecuador. They are not only harming his career, they're harming the Fred Astaire studio, said Zuquilanda's mother, Liliana Serrano, who lives in Connecticut. Immigration legal experts point to the Buy American and Hire American executive order Trump signed in April 2017 as one reason for delays. The order was meant to increase earnings and employment rates for Americans by strongly enforcing immigration laws. Mark Krikorian is executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, which supports greater immigration controls. He says that he feels sorry for small business owners, but they should not blame federal immigration policy for their labor problems. It's one thing if you're talking about world-renowned nuclear physicists, where there's a handful of people on the planet who have an ability and we want them here. Everybody gets that, he said. Dance instructors? I'm sorry. That's something for the market to deal with. A representative for the U.S. Department of State said there has been no policy change dealing with the O-1 visas. Michael Wilds is an immigration lawyer for First Lady Melania Trump and her family. In a newspaper opinion piece, he argued that legal experts working for fashion designers, models, and photographers have experienced never-before-seen levels of pushback from immigration officials. He warned that many skilled and creative non-Americans might stop seeking work in the U.S. if the process continues as is or slows further. I'm Pete Musto.
The United States has threatened to declare tariffs of up to 100% on $2.4 billion in imports from France. The targeted products would include bottles of champagne, handbags, and cheese. The Trump administration said it was considering the tariffs after finding that France's new digital services tax would harm U.S. technology companies. French President Emmanuel Macron pushed forward with the digital tax over the summer, ignoring U.S. anger at the measure. The administration says the tax unfairly targets American businesses. The French leader wants to reach an international agreement on taxing large technology companies. It has urged U.S. officials to help reform taxes on businesses that operate overseas. Here is a guide to the digital tax debate. Large tech companies such as Facebook are able to report profits in low-tax countries like Ireland and Luxembourg, no matter where the money comes from. Macron says taxing such companies is a matter of social justice. The French leader campaigned hard for a digital tax to cover European Union member states, but faced resistance from Ireland, Denmark, Sweden, and Finland. After talks on a European Union digital tax failed, the French government passed its own digital tax in July. The 3% tax relates to revenue from digital services earned by companies with more than 25 million euros in revenue from France and 750 million euros worldwide. France is not alone among European countries in proposing a tax on big tech. Britain, Spain, Italy, Austria, Mexico, and Canada have also announced plans for their own digital taxes. What does Macron want to achieve? His goal is to get a wider agreement on digital taxation under the auspices of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The OECD is a group of 36 mostly industrial countries, including the United States. At a G20 meeting in June, finance ministers agreed to set common rules to close tax loopholes and promised to work toward a solution by 2020. The following month, G7 finance ministers agreed there should be a minimum level, or smallest amount, of tax to stop countries from competing in a race to the bottom. The United States once supported the new international tax system to cover many different companies. But officials say the U.S. changed its mind recently when traditional companies found out that they would be taxed too. The issue of digital taxation has led to a new trade dispute between U.S. and EU officials as economic relations between the two turn ugly. Low-tax countries like Ireland also have expressed concern about the French digital tax. They say the measure would make it harder for them to increase foreign direct investment with the promise of low taxes. I'm Susan Shand.
A team of scientists says that playing sounds underwater can get fish to return to areas with severely damaged coral reefs. In an experiment, they found fish returned after hearing recordings of the sounds of a healthy ocean reef. The international team included scientists from the British universities of Exeter and Bristol, as well as Australia's James Cook University. The research results were reported in the publication Nature Communications. The scientists placed underwater speakers in areas where coral had been dying in Australia's northern Great Barrier Reef. They played the sounds over a period of about 6 weeks in 2017 and studied the results. The team reported that twice as many fish arrived in areas where the sounds of healthy coral were played. The sounds also led to a 50% increase in the number of species present in the area, the researchers found. Among the arriving fish were species that feed on all major food sources. The researchers noted the importance of having many different kinds of fish return to the area. Different species of fish perform many activities that support the ocean environment and sea life. Damaged reefs have a higher chance of recovery if they have healthy fish populations, the scientists wrote in the report. Steve Simpson is a professor at the University of Exeter who helped lead the research. He said in a statement that healthy coral reefs are remarkably noisy places. They contain the sounds of many kinds of shrimp, fish, and other sea creatures. Young fish listen for these sounds when they are looking for a place to settle, Simpson said. He added that reefs become ghostly quiet when they suffer destruction that is usually related to human-caused pollution. Coral damage can cause unappealing smells and sounds that drive shrimp and fish away. But the experiment suggested that the use of underwater loudspeakers was an effective way to get young fish to come back. Mark Meekin is a fish biologist with the Australian Institute of Marine Science. He said in a statement that the return of these fish is the first step to seeing major improvements in reef health. Recovery is underpinned by fish that clean the reef and create space for corals to regrow, he said. Tim Gordon was another member of the research team from the University of Exeter. He says he believes sound can be used to bring back dead coral in areas suffering major destruction in oceans across the world. Boosting fish populations in this way could help to kickstart natural recovery processes, counteracting the damage we're seeing on many coral reefs around the world, Gordon said. University of Bristol Professor Andy Radford said the underwater sounds are a promising way to fight coral reef damage at the local community level. But he noted that other threats need to be reduced as well. These include climate change, pollution, and overfishing. Gordon added, from local management innovations to international political action, we need meaningful progress at all levels to paint a better future for reefs worldwide. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. America's Civil War in the 1860s did not have the full support of the people. Many said they did not care who won, North or South. They just wanted to be left alone. In the North, many young men refused to be drafted into the Union Army. Some of their protests turned violent. Southern leaders were pleased with the anti-war movement in the North. Confederate General Robert E. Lee saw it as a sign of weakness in the Northern war effort. He also saw it as an opening for a military victory. Lee hoped for a final, decisive blow that would bring the war to an end. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe talk about General Lee's campaign north to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Gettysburg was a small town. Many roads came together there. Robert E. Lee needed those roads to pull his army together quickly. He had 70,000 men in all, but they were spread over a wide area of southern Pennsylvania. Some were at York to the east, some were at Carlisle to the north, and most were at Chambersburg to the west. All of them were ordered to move against the Union force at Gettysburg. General Robert E. Lee had not planned to go to Gettysburg. He had planned to capture Harrisburg, the state capital, and then Philadelphia. If successful, he would turn south to seize Baltimore and Washington. Lee had not worried about the large Union Army of the Potomac. He believed it was far behind him in Virginia. But Lee was wrong. The Union Army had followed him, and it had reached Gettysburg first.
The first group of Northern soldiers formed a thin line of defense outside Gettysburg. The first group of Southern soldiers attacked this line. It was the morning of July 1st, 1863. When the guns began to roar, both sides hurried more men to the front. After hours of fighting, the Confederates had pushed the Union soldiers back through the town. The Union soldiers formed a new line along a place called Cemetery Hill. General Robert E. Lee decided not to attack the hill immediately. He would wait for more men. But as he waited, more and more Union soldiers arrived. By sunrise the next day, Lee's 70,000 men faced a Union army of 90,000 men.
The Confederates attacked both sides of the Union line. They moved the Union soldiers a little, but then the Union soldiers came back again. The Confederates could not hold the line. The fighting stopped at sunset. Union Commander George Meade met with his generals. He said he was sure General Lee would attack again the next day. The next attack, Meade said, would be against the center of the Union line. Meade was right. Lee planned to send 15,000 men against the Union center. They would be under the command of General George Pickett.
When the sun rose on July 3rd, the Union troops were ready. They watched as the Confederate troops set up their cannon. More than 130 of these big guns were aimed at the center of the Union line. The morning passed. The day grew hotter. A little past 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a Confederate gun fired once, then again. That was the signal to attack. All at once, the Confederate artillery thundered with a deafening roar. The cannon sent iron and smoke into the Union soldiers on Cemetery Hill. Within minutes, hundreds lay dead or dying. Union artillery on the hill answered the Confederate cannon. Men lay flat on the ground. They prayed for the shelling to stop. Finally, it did, and the smoke of battle began to clear.
Now the Union soldiers could see across the valley. They watched as the Confederate soldiers formed a long line. It was a sight to take your breath away. Facing Cemetery Hill, the Confederates stood shoulder to shoulder in a line almost 2 kilometers long. Sunlight shone from their guns. Their battle flags waved. Slowly, the line began to move. It seemed more like a parade than an attack. Shouts went up and down the Union line. Here they come. Here come the rebels.
Thousands of Confederate soldiers moved across the valley outside Gettysburg. Union artillery opened fire. The guns tore open big holes in the Confederate battle line. But the Southerners kept moving forward up the hill. Union soldiers rose up from behind stone walls and fallen trees. They poured even more gunfire into the Confederate line. More and more bodies fell to the ground. Still, the line moved forward. A few Confederates reached the Union line, but not enough to seize it. They were shot down. Suddenly, the Confederates began racing down the hill. Many raised their hands in surrender. 15,000 began the attack. Only half returned. The Battle of Gettysburg was over. The Union commander, General Meade, was told that the Confederate attack had been broken. He said simply, "Thank God." The Confederate commander, General Lee, said, "This has been a sad day for us. A sad day."
Lee's invasion of the North had failed. There was only one thing he could do now, retreat. He must get his army back to Virginia. He could only hope that the Union army was hurt too badly to chase him. The line of wagons carrying wounded soldiers was 25 kilometers long. Many of the wounded needed treatment. But the wagons were not permitted to stop for any reason. Suffering was terrible. An officer who led the wagon train said he learned more about the horrors of war on that one trip than he had learned in all of his battles. 20,000 Confederate soldiers were killed, wounded, or listed as missing in the Battle of Gettysburg. 23,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing.
General Meade lost so many men that he was in no hurry to chase General Lee. He believed it might be best to let Lee escape than to take a chance on losing what remained of the Army of the Potomac. Meade waited for a week until his army was stronger. But by then, Lee and his men had crossed safely back into Virginia. President Abraham Lincoln was angry. He had told General Meade that driving the Confederates out of the North was not enough. The Southern army must be destroyed. "We had them," Lincoln said. "We had only to stretch out our hands and take them, and nothing I could do or say could make the army move."
President Lincoln believed that General Meade had made a mistake, but he felt that the general had ability. Lincoln was thankful for what Meade had done at Gettysburg. He said Meade would continue to command the Army of the Potomac. In November of 1863, President Lincoln went to Gettysburg. He attended the opening of a new burial place for the Union soldiers who had died in the great battle there.
The governor of Pennsylvania had asked the president to say a few words at the ceremony. Lincoln agreed. He felt it was his duty to go, to honor the brave men who lost their lives to save the Union. Lincoln hoped his words might help lift the spirit of the nation. Lincoln did not have much time to prepare his speech. He wrote it down the night before the ceremony. Lincoln was sure the speech was not a good one, but it came to be one of the most famous speeches in American history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.